This morning I'm speaking with Len Goodman, Executive Director for New Mexican Natural Medicine. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Len.
Thank you.
So New Mexican is a general information center, it would seem, really about all things cannabis in New Mexico. Can you tell me a little bit about this organization?
Well, New Mexican Natural Medicine, we just call it New Mexican, make it easier. We're one of the 23 licensed producers in the state. The state licenses...
Producers of cannabis.
Producers of cannabis. There's a medical cannabis program, which is the statute mandated that the Department of Health set up both a cultivation and distribution system for patients in New Mexico who need medical cannabis to manage one of the approved conditions after doctor recommendations. So there, right now there are 23... licensed producers. The Department of Health has licensed 23 producers, and these producers, it's a vertical setup. You don't have a distinction between cultivators and dispensaries. The producers grow, harvest, have and register patients for their production, and distribute medicine to those patients, either through a storefront or office or a delivery system. It varies depending on the producer. We also do a lot more than that, and we're focused on patient care. We give classes on pain management, use of cannabis, different methods of ingestion, immune system building through cannabis and other herbal supplements. We consult with patients. There's varieties of strains, differences between THC, CBD, cannabidiol, different cannabinoids function differently for different conditions, different methods of ingestion. Smoking is a whole different mechanism from eating and ingesting. Different, it's different receptors, different conversions to the active ingredients. So we work with patients a lot. Most of our time is spent working with patients.
Now, this has to be relatively new because... we're talking about medical marijuana, and that has been legal here in the state really just since 2007, a statute signed by Bill Richardson, the Lynn and Aaron Compassionate Use Act. Can we talk about how medical marijuana became legalized here in the state?
Well, I got to tell you, I'm far from an expert on that, and I was not involved in the actual political process of getting it done, but I am now. The movement really started, as far as I know, under Gary Johnson.
Who was the highest-ranking Republican at the time to advocate legalization of marijuana. I don't know if he still is, but he was at the time.
He was a presidential candidate, so maybe he's the highest-ranking independent now. I'm not sure. But, yeah, he started the process, and the momentum slowly built within the legislature for it. Not enough to pass. There was a policy organization, Drug Policy Alliance, which is a national organization who set up a satellite office in New Mexico. I think they had offices at that time in only three states. And they put in a tremendous amount of time, energy, money, and focus in helping lobbying for it. Slowly, a group of legislators coalesced around that, and slowly momentum built for it. Eventually, when Bill Richardson got in office, it was possible, after several attempts, to get it through. And in 2007, it passed.
And Lynn and Aaron, are these two people who were part of the process?
They were two people who needed cannabis for medical use, and they were the focus of the project to get it done, and it was named after them. They were a strong force behind it, as I understand it.
So let's talk, you mentioned a little bit earlier, some of the uses of it, but let's talk about the importance of cannabis for some people suffering pain, degenerative diseases. I think at this point there are 16 qualifying conditions for people,
if I remember correctly,
to be able to access cannabis. So talk to us a little bit about how cannabis has been used and why it is such a good medication for some individuals.
Cannabis has been around and used as medicine for about 5,000 years. The oldest pharmacopoeia that we have, the first herbal text, was a Chinese text, which documented somewhere in the neighborhood. This goes back, I'm not sure of the dating on it. I think it was about 500 BC when it was first written. documented, if I remember right, 350 different herbs and their uses. And the queen herb was considered cannabis. It had the widest applications of any herb in that pharmacopoeia, and it was used widely, and it's been used widely. It's always been in most parts of the world a medicinal supplement, besides an intoxicant at certain times, but as a medicinal supplement. And it's only in it was only in the 20th century that we decided to turn it into a boogeyman. It was the widest prescribed medication in the United States pharmacies at the turn of the century. It became second around World War I when opiates took over, and it became the second most prescribed medication. You can go on eBay and you can look at major pharmaceutical companies like Lilly. You can buy the old bottles for tinctures. It was widely used and widely distributed, and until the insanity of the 30s took over, it was recognized as a valuable medicine, as a valuable herbal medicine, and it still is. We're discovering more and more applications for it for all sorts of things. The 16 conditions are just the tip of the iceberg, and those are 16 conditions in New Mexico. If you put the conditions together from the different states, you wind up with a list of close to, I think it's 28 different conditions that nationally are recognized in different states as being of value. And there's far more than that. We know very, very little about this plant because the research is limited.
And I'll just name some of these conditions. The severe chronic pain, painful peripheral neuropathy, intractable nausea, vomiting. A lot of people who are undergoing chemotherapy use it to control nausea, hepatitis C infection, Crohn's disease, PTSD. Let's talk about that for a second, because I think that New Mexico is one of the first states to specifically allow people with PTSD to be treated with post-traumatic stress. Is that correct?
Yeah, New Mexico was the first state to recognize it. There are now four states, I believe, that recognize it as a viable condition for getting a recommendation for medical cannabis.
And is this openly used? I mean, do you know, in your experience, do you have a lot of vets who come to you for services?
We have a lot of vets who come. We have a lot of PTSD patients who are not vets.
Across the board, of course.
You know, the traumatic accidents, childhood abuse, rape. There's a slew of them. PTSD is not limited to vets. It's our highest percentage because I don't remember the percentage numbers of vets who are returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, but it's very high who are suffering from PTSD. So is that population has a very high percentage, so we see a lot of it. But for what it's doing, it's in my mind, it's a little unfortunate that PTSD is the only psychological diagnosis, because what cannabis can do is act as an extremely effective, far more effective than most pharmaceuticals for most people, as an antidepressant, as an anti-anxiety, as a sleep aid. All of these are the symptoms of PTSD that are being dealt with, anger management. And it's far more effective for most people, myself included, for managing those conditions than any of the pharmaceuticals. Personally, I think depression should be a condition. I think anxiety should be a condition. I think insomnia should be a condition. So it's only if you're, quote, fortunate enough to have PTSD that you can deal with your insomnia by using cannabis.
Officially diagnosed. Is this a moment to talk a little bit about CB1 receptors? I mean, I was trying to research some specifically why THC would be used for this, and it sounded like this receptor in the brain called CB1 was a precise match for the chemicals called cannabinoids found in the cannabis plant. So there are actual parts of our brain that react specifically to cannabis that may not react to anything else. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's actually, it's even more ubiquitous than that. We have a cannabinoid system within our body. It's the endogenous cannabinoid system. It's called the endocannabinoid system. The same as we have a lymph system and an endocrine system, we have a cannabinoid system. It was only recently discovered. We produce our own cannabinoid, an anandamide, and it's it's viewed as a super regulator, that the other systems in the body seem to be kept in line so they can do their job by the endocannabinoid system. But in any event, we have our own system. It's been there. It exists in most living creatures, mm-hmm. have a cannabinoid system. It's not just human beings. And that system, so we produce this stuff. We have receptors. We know of three right now. There are a lot more, but there's the CB1, CB2, and AG something or other is another one. And they all work
into the weeds of the science, but I think it's important. It's important for people to know why this is specifically useful.
Sure. And they respond differently. I mean, that's the CB1 receptors are in the central nervous system. Mm-hmm. CB2 receptors are scattered throughout the body. They're triggered differently. They do different things.
We are talking with Len Goodman, Executive Director for New Mexican Natural Medicine, about medical marijuana. Can you tell us about the process then? And I hear now there are over 9,300 active patients here in New Mexico as of July 2nd?
Yeah, that's correct.
And are there enough outlets? Are there enough plants here to serve people who need medical marijuana? And also, can you talk a little bit about the application process to be eligible?
Sure. In my opinion, there is not enough. There's not enough medicine available to serve patients. It's certainly the case for New Mexican. There's an argument as to whether that's the case throughout the state, and that's being looked into, and Department of Health is doing surveys to try and establish whether or not there's sufficient medicine. But I can talk about New Mexican and our experience. All producers have a limitation as to how much they can grow. The rules and regs limit us to 150 plants total. That's all the way from seedling to final cut of harvest. It's a total of 150. When the first rules and regs were put out, it was only 95. We started with that. We went, the first producers were licensed in 2009. We were one of them. And we had a 95 plant cap. At the end of 2010, the rules and regs were changed, very largely through Governor Richardson's insistence prior to his leaving office, because Governor Martinez had already announced that she was opposed to the program. There was a concern that no new producers would be licensed. And the rules went through a public hearing process. And with Governor Richardson's help, the plant count was raised to 150. The number of producers at that time went from 11 to 25. But we're limited. We're limited to what we can grow. Then patients can buy wherever they want. They're not restricted to registering with a single producer. So they can register with multiple producers. At New Mexican, we're limited by 150 plants. We maximize our yields on that as much as we can. We're one of the largest producers. We see, we distribute approximately, in the last quarterly report, I think it worked out, this, we distribute 330 orders on average a week.
A week?
A week. We turn down somewhere between 200 and 300 requests for medicine beyond that every week.
And is that because you don't have it in stock, or other reasons?
No, we don't have it. We don't have it. We have we're on a rotational harvest system. We harvest weekly. After harvesting, it takes 4 to 6 weeks to dry and cure before it's ready for sale. So we announce new harvest every Saturday afternoon on our website, by an email, and on the outgoing voice message. Pre-orders start flowing in at that point.
Okay.
We come in Monday morning, and we start keying them in. We are sold out somewhere between noon on Monday and at the latest noon on Tuesday. Patients will come in all week long to pick up their medicine. They've ordered it. It's like a pharmacy. You call in a prescription. It's waiting for you. But anybody calling in or emailing in after that point in time is told, I'm sorry, we're out. We don't have anything. They have to look elsewhere. They may be able to find it another Santa Fe distributor. They are mostly in the same situation as we are. and they either do without or they have to turn to illegal sources.
Now, if they've been approved, can they grow their own plants if they'd like?
In principle, yes. When you apply to the program as a patient, you can also apply for a personal production license, which is, as far as I know, almost always granted. I know very few that have been turned down. The only reason they're turned down is a question of security.
Okay.
But a patient can apply. There's no charge to become a patient. There's no fee with the state. There is a $30 annual fee for a PPL unless you're 200% below the below 200% above the poverty level. Then it's free.
So you're saying that most people who do apply will be approved. So it's not like there's this long waiting list of applicants who aren't even approved to get medical marijuana. Is that correct? Pretty much anyone who applies is approved. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, there's a time lag. It takes 4 to 6 weeks from the time you turn in your paperwork to get your card. No, because all the department is reviewing, as far as I know, is to make sure there's no fraud involved.
Okay.
People who want to be in the program, they're going to see doctors. Doctors are filling out the paperwork. Doctors are recommending it. It's not a prescription. They're saying, yes, this person, I certify this person has this condition, and they've tried other medications that haven't worked. It's worth trying cannabis.
And are you finding people, is there still this kind of cloak of shame? I mean, I'm sure a lot of people have jumped on who know the benefits of cannabis and who are excited about it. But for others, there still may be this stigma that somewhere it's considered an illegal drug and they have stigmas around it. Do you find that when you interact with people?
Yeah, there's, we have a very, very wide population. The demographic of who comes to us is all over the map. But sure, there are people who... particularly older people in their 60s and 70s, who have spent their entire life thinking marijuana is a horrible thing. It's a gateway drug to heroin. They've taught their kids to stay away from it. They're convincing their grandkids not to go near it. And now their doctor's telling them, you should do this. It's the only thing that's going to work for your pain. You're going through chemo, right? The anti-nausea drugs aren't working. Become a patient, smoke cannabis, it's going to work. So they're coming in and they're very, very nervous. One, they think they're coming into a drug den, right? And they're very surprised to come into a really nice office with good people and good discussions and normalcy. But they're very, very hesitant. There was one guy, interesting guy, who professional, and he has MS. It had been proposed to him. He had resisted it. He was somebody whose first glass of wine was when he was 40, right? And was convinced that marijuana was going to lead him to heroin. But his wife convinced him to try it. He got a recommendation. He did. It's the best management for his MS condition he's ever had. He's been able to drop medications that were causing horrible side effects for him. And now he's a very vocal advocate for the program. And that's not unusual.
That's wonderful to see that transformation around that.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Well, but it also brings up that there's not only stigma there. I mean, the federal law still says that it's illegal to have pot. So how do people reconcile with possibly having pot and going over state lines? Or how does that interact with federal law?
It's tricky. First of all, according to the program rules, a patient is not to transport out of state.
Okay.
And that would be a violation of the rules. It's not that people don't do it. I mean, what do? You live in New Mexico. You've got to go somewhere else on business or travel for family, and you need your pain medication. It's like saying, yeah, you're going to go to California for your granddaughter's wedding, and you got to leave all your opiate painkillers at home, right? How are you going to survive? There's a reason why you're taking it. So people take risks, but it's a risk. As far as we're concerned, everybody who is producing and distributing cannabis through this program is subject at any time the feds want to being busted. We are not even allowed to present a defense in court that we are medical providers. It's not permitted under the federal rules of evidence. And we are subject to either a 5-year mandatory minimum sentence or New Mexican is now subject to a 10-year mandatory minimum sentence. Once you, we've harvested well over 1,000 plants, so we certainly crossed the threshold. That's what we're subject to. We could wake up tomorrow and be arrested with no defense at all.
Wow. And yet you continue to do this because you believe in it, I'm assuming.
Yeah, it's a combination. I believe in it very, very strongly. And I'm also betting that it's not going to happen.
Right.
I'm also assuming when I cross the street, I'm going to get to the other side. Some people don't make it. Right?
So considering that you pay gross receipts tax to the state, I mean, the state would also be implicated here. I mean, I think last year, $3.3 million in sale of medical cannabis, of which the state took in over almost 240,000 gross receipts tax. So this is quite beneficial for the state in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and actually that number's already been, that amount of revenue has already been crossed at the end of June. It'll be over $7 million this year.
Over $7 million. Yeah. So this is leaping kind of exponentially in terms of the returns.
Yeah, and it would be substantially more. I mean, we are, if we could grow more medicine and we could distribute more, it would be substantial. We're turning down half of our patients every week and saying, sorry, we can't fill your order.
So what are the discussions ongoing then with the state, with Governor Martinez? Has she vocalized anything? I think there was some resistance initially, but she's really stayed quiet on the topic, right?
Yeah, she has, and I don't have any direct information, but I know that there hasn't been anything coming from the governor's office. There have been no attacks, and there have been no thrusts against it. The Department of Health has commissioned an independent survey. They expect the results in August or September to ascertain whether or not, in their opinion, there's a shortage. You know, I know there's a shortage at our distribution center and a shortage for our patients. The question is that true across the state?
So this may change. This may change and you'll be able to advance.
Well, one would hope so, but, you know, there's two factors. One is, what's the reality? And everyone needs to agree, is there a shortage or isn't there a shortage?
Right, right.
And then what's the political reality? Is there, you know, does the governor want to see more producers or a higher plant count, or is politics going to stop it? Another question, which is a serious question in my mind, the statute, the Linen-Aaron Compassionate Use Act, mandated that the Department of Health create a system of production and distribution for patients in need for safe access to safe medicine. They're mandated to create sufficient supply. If the Department of Health recognizes that there's a shortage, they have a statutory obligation to meet it. So you might wind up with administrative politics butting heads with legislature politics. I don't know.
Let's, we just have a few more seconds, but this new law in Colorado, for example, making recreational marijuana smoking legal in Washington, is this normalizing medical marijuana and marijuana in general?
It's certainly normalizing things. No one knows what the impact of adult use legalization is going to have on the medical community and the medical cannabis community. And it's anybody's guess. There very likely will be a price discrepancy. Colorado is looking at a 25% excise tax. Washington's looking at a 30% excise tax.
Everybody's getting
right.
into it,
everybody's
aren't they?
Well, that's the motivating force for legalization.
Absolutely.
It's tax revenue. It's and why not? Because it's being done. It's not like the business doesn't exist.
Right.
All of that revenue exists. It's all happening, but it's happening in the black market, which means there's no social benefit to it.
So you have the economic benefit. You actually have the health benefits. And imagine that with the costs of medicine right now. That's something that's actually effective. So people, can they go to your website to get more information? Len Goodman, Executive Director for New Mexican Natural Medicine.
Yeah, the website is NewMexican.org. I just put an extra N at the end of New Mexican for cannabis. So NewMexican.org, and sure, we'd love you to go to our website. There's also a lot of information on the Department of Health website on the rules and regs and procedures and applications for becoming a patient.
And if people want to apply and they have questions, they could also go to your organization, go to you to ask about that, or directly to the Department of Health.
We help people. We give people the information. We can't create the recommendations. They have to see their doctors. We have the paperwork. We can steer them towards doctors who are more favorable and are open to it. Most aren't, unfortunately, in New Mexico.
But I would assume there are plenty here in Santa Fe who are, so you would have a list of them?
There aren't that many who are willing to do it for a variety of reasons, and part of it has to do with how they're perceived within the medical community and by the medical board. It's tricky. There's a stigma within the medical profession that they're afraid of applying to them, just like patients or doctors who are afraid of becoming known as pot docs.
Well, hopefully, as we have more of these conversations and more legalization campaigns going on, then this will change. I mean, we can only hope for the stigma. But thank you so much for being with me today and sharing this information.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Zayla.
Hello, welcome back. I am speaking now with Craig Barnes of We Are People Here and Nico Lichen on public banking alternatives. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Craig Barnes and Nico Lichen.
Thank you. Uh-huh. Great to be here.
So it seems that public banking is a new national conversation. Can you talk about what it means to advocate for public banking?
You betcha. There's a turmoil going on in the banking system we've got. There's been a kind of a collapse of effectiveness of the Federal Reserve, a collapse of the effectiveness of the Congress, the presidency. Everything is grinding to a halt. And what we've come to understand is that whoever controls the money supply really controls the health of the economy of the country, and the Wall Street banks, the four or five Wall Street banks, control the money supply, and they're not doing it. They're not getting business going in Santa Fe, they're not getting business going in the county, they're not getting business going anywhere in the country. So that public banking is a completely different alternative. That's banking where the currency is issued, or the money is issued by a public bank, so that a bank that's owned by the public. So a bank that could be owned by the city of Santa Fe, for example, could put Santa Fe's $200 million in reserves, not in Wells Fargo, but in a bank, a local bank, which could invest its interest returns in public policy projects in Santa Fe. So the idea is, as you say, it is spreading across the country. There are multiple parties now working on it, thinking about it, talking about it all over the country.
So, Nico, can we go a little bit more into the how of this? You say the $200 million reserves. What would the city of Santa Fe have to do, and what would this bank exactly look like?
Well, it's not just the city of Santa Fe. It could also be tribal governments. It could be the county. Brian Egolf has introduced legislation for a state-owned bank of New Mexico. So it's any publicly owned entity that could establish a bank to serve the people of their region or their district or their constituents. So what they'd have to do would be to get a charter. You set up a policy board, you hire a good banker, and then you begin to invest and leverage assets, things that governments take in the form of taxes and fees and assessments, to benefit the constituency.
So a lot of people refer to the difference between private banking is that it's really seeking short-term profits. I mean, they have to appeal to the shareholders, whereas a public bank would be in the public interest, I mean, under the best circumstances, correct? So we would consider whatever the public needs as opposed to just looking at the bottom line. So this is what the state would have to be doing, pretty much responding, or the city, responding to constituent interests.
Right. It's how the charter is written and how the purpose of the bank is set up. So it's important to do that right at the beginning.
So what was the response to EGOLF's proposal?
Well, the legislation needs more education throughout the state, and We Are People Here feel that maybe the best place for us to begin is locally, where people know us best and people understand the local challenges that we're experiencing because of the way banking has not served the public interest.
There's a recurring theme in American history. Probably no theme other than slavery has played such a central role in American history as the public versus the big banks or a central bank. Beginning with Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, all the way down to the present, the issue of who controls the money supply has been a dominant one. And in the last 30 years, we've kind of forgotten it. But here it is now, when the economy is collapsing, and the economy is not putting people to work, and the big banks are making record profits. somebody has to, and the, you know, the bonuses that the big bank CEOs are getting are just off the charts, obscene. And you have to say, wait a minute, this isn't actually a new movement in 2013. This is a movement that's been going on since the founding of the Republic. And what we are doing is getting in touch again with the reasons why it's been going on for so long, and understanding that if the money money and credit are actually a public utility. It shouldn't be controlled by banks. It should be controlled by the public. The kings and Caesars used to issue the money because it belonged to the state. It doesn't belong to Wells Fargo and Citibank. It belongs to the. It's part of the duties of government to provide money where it's needed in order to get. This morning's paper says that there are two Head Start programs closing down in New Mexico. Why is that happening? You know, the banks are walking away with record profits, and we're closing that Head Start because the federal government can't pay for it. Federal government or the state government or the city government was using the interest on lending to do public policy projects. You could begin to fill up the potholes. You could begin to build the bridges you need. You could begin to finance the schools you want here in Santa Fe, Santa Fe County, the state of Mexico. All of that is possible if you control the money supply, and a public bank can do that.
And it's probably really coming up in conversations because everything has gotten so extreme. I mean, environmental, climate disruption, like you say, this concentration of wealth and power, the CEOs getting, I mean, it's just astronomical, the amount of money they're getting that could probably run every Head Start in New Mexico for several years, right?
Exactly that. And there is a way in which this cycle has been repeated often. This cycle of the concentration of wealth, this inequality, was exaggerated in the late 1890s, and then there was a collapse. It's exaggerated in 2008, and then there was a collapse. And what we have to do is, we're part of this conversation. People say, what are you talking about banking? I mean, good God, why aren't you talking about the school? Why aren't you talking about the climate change? Well, all of that actually traces back to, can you put people to work in an appropriate way? Can you serve public policy when the forests are burning? Can you spend some way to do conservation instead of exploitation? And all of that means that you have to get control of who makes the loans.
And I love the fact that public banking was first introduced in America by the Quakers. Those Quakers are wonderful. What would we do without the Quakers in the original colony of Pennsylvania? But there is a state now that uses public banking. Can we talk about North Dakota?
You betcha. Nicole and I both are steeped in North Dakota. North Dakota got a public bank in 1919. Nicole, why don't you go ahead and talk about that?
Well, it came about primarily because the farmers were being controlled and basically starved out by the big banks, by the railroads. And they fought and finally were successful in getting state bank legislation passed and getting it established. But really, it wasn't until 10 years later when the conservatives came into office that they realized what a good deal it could be for the state of North Dakota. And that's when it really started to turn a profit and be successful. And the Bank of North Dakota has turned a profit for the state for the last 40 years. Long before the oil boom ever started, and they're the only state that went through the whole recession with no red ink and kept turning a profit. They have helped their constituents out when there have been flooding. They finance college for students. They do homes for farmers in rural areas. But, you know, it's a closed loop. It's an economy of scale. That's how I think of it. And we're realizing this on a lot of levels, that the scale at which we're doing things is not within our control, the food, the environment. And so they're able to make loans and invest in small businesses and in the community and in services because they know the people they're serving. Well, it's that good faith and credit in the people that matters so much. But there's another public bank, or there's actually three of them in Oklahoma. Those are tribally owned. One of them is Bank 2. And there's an example of a federally owned public bank, and maybe some people that are older will remember the United States Postal Service and Bank and Savings. And there is look at reviving that now at this time as well.
What happened to that? Why did these close down?
It hasn't closed down. It's still vestigial, and it's possible to revive it. I don't know that much about it. Maybe it's because the big banks came on or banks were more accessible. But at one time, the post office was also part of the Commonwealth. It also was really at the heart of the community. And so it was accessible to everybody, and people could save their money there.
You know, about in North Dakota, I was reading some figures on there. In the spring of 2010, it was not only the only state with a major budget surplus, it had the lowest unemployment default rates in the country and the most community banks per capita. So, I mean, there's so many reasons why this can be really positive. And can you talk a little bit more about the floods that happened there? Because this is a very immediate thing, especially with climate crises and with things happening. How states can actually respond to their local communities in the face of tragedies. The flood, I believe, was in April 1997?
Mm-hmm. It's a great metaphor, actually, because the State Bank of North Dakota, when Grand Forks was in North Dakota, it was flooded on both sides of the river. On both sides of the river, of course, one side was in North Dakota, one side was in Minnesota. And on the North Dakota side, today you go up there and the community is rebuilt. On the Minnesota side, the community is still run down, ramshackle, because the banks have, as you can imagine, the private banks have, damn, this place is run down and the paint's fallen off and it's been destroyed by flood. This is not a good place to invest. Bank of North Dakota on its side of the river said, we have a public purpose to serve here. And we're going to help recreate the businesses and the homes in this community, and have done so. So if you go there now, it's Grand Forks, North Dakota. It's a bustling, burgeoning community. You go across the river, and it's looking like it's run down and dilapidated. So that's a thing that there's a different underlying theme in a publicly owned bank. And that theme is we're here to serve the public and not just shareholders. And when we make profit as a bank, still operating as a bank, when we make profit, we run that profit back into the local economy rather than out to Wall Street and out to the global exchange. And that makes a huge difference. So that in North Dakota, during the depression times in the 1930s, when farmers were going under, they owed the public bank money. But the public bank didn't do what Wells Fargo and the Citibank and the big banks of Minneapolis and Chicago at that time did. The North Dakota bank said, okay, boys, stay on the farm. Pay us rent. We'll accumulate the amount you owe. You owe a lot. You stay on the farm, keep the farm working, and when the rains come and the depression is over, we'll, by golly, put you back into the business so you can pay us off. And that's exactly what happened. So in the 1940s, those farmers were still on the farm. The land hadn't been repossessed by big banks, hadn't been sold out for development by big banks. And the farmers stayed on the land and got their farms back, paid them off. And that kept the whole of North Dakota in a better position than it ever been.
Amazing. I'm speaking today with Craig Barnes and Nico Lycan of We Are People Here about public banking alternatives. Can you discuss the difference between a public bank and a community bank, if there's a difference? Because I believe we have community banks here in Santa Fe.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Absolutely. A community bank is an essential part of the system. A local bank, the local community banks here in the Santa Fe area, for example, the Los Alamos National Bank, or the credit unions, those are an essential part of the system. And what a public bank could do, where a state bank or a city bank, county bank, it could reinforce the lending of the local banks. So it doesn't replace them, it supports them. And that's what's happened in North Dakota. So if there are difficult loans for a North Dakota community bank to do, the public bank will say, okay, we'll take half of it. We'll guarantee half of that loan, or we'll support half of that loan. And that's what could happen here.
And that's similar to what Representative Eagle's legislation was. So it actually supports community banks throughout the state.
And so what are some of the fears around this? I mean, I know that there are some misconceptions, and maybe I can go through some of them if you can address them, about public banking being much riskier than the current system.
Really? I don't know how anyone could say that after what we've been through.
Well, it's amazing, but these are some of the misconceptions I've come across. Public banks compete with private banks. You addressed that a little. Public banks are already providing the services that public banks would replicate. And that the government, being in the banking business, is both inefficient and a potential source for mischief caused by politicians. So these are some of the main ones. Oh, also the return on the state's investment with public banks would not be significantly better than the return on investments, which the state is currently receiving with private banks. So five main misconceptions that seem to be floating out in the
Let's just take them one by one.
So the first is that public banking would be riskier than the current system.
It's not actually, because you're investing in people that you know, and the rate of return is smaller, and you're partnering with people that you know. You know that all the investments basically, now a public bank is typically a banker's bank. It's not a bank like you or I would put our money into. We would continue to put our money in community banks. But the county or the city or the state or a tribal entity would invest their assets in a public bank. So they're self-insured. We don't run the risk of dealing with FDIC and having FDIC go broke and raiding the banks like they did recently.
All these bailouts.
And when you think of the riskiness, what could have been riskier than the 2007-2008 collapse?
Absolutely.
Of Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers, and the realization now that the five global banks that are in Wall Street have 58% assets worth 58% of the GDP of the country. Too big to fail means you can't. They could fail, but if they did, the whole country goes down. And that's what happened in 2008. That's
so the government necessarily has to step in and bail them out. Now, could the same
exactly
be said
what
for
happened
smaller?
In 2008, because they were risky. They were so risky that they jeopardized the whole country. Well, if a state bank has a bad loan, it's not going to jeopardize the whole country.
They were also risky and irresponsible. I mean, the two don't necessarily need to be synonymous, but in that case,
And one of the ways in which they were especially risky is they took loans and repackaged them and divided them up in these collateralized debt obligations and derivatives that were terribly unfounded. So as Nicole says, they didn't know on Wall Street when they packaged these hundreds and hundreds of loans in new instruments. They didn't know what farmer was going to pay that loan off, or what householder was going to pay that loan. And in banking, if you don't know who's responsible for the loan, you're in deep trouble. And then what they did, because they didn't know what the chain of title was to fabricate and fraudulently make up the documents in the chain of title. That's risky.
And I would say again, irresponsible.
And irresponsible.
Right.
So the second illegal.
And illegal, exactly. Yeah. Well, that's a different conversation, isn't it?
Yes,
it is. The legality. Public banks competing with private banks.
The vision is that they actually, in North Dakota, there's a good number of privately owned banks that collaborate with the Bank of North Dakota, and that would be the vision that we would have in New Mexico, that they could rely on the state of New Mexico for matching funds to enable loans to businesses, to homeowners, and it would reduce the risk to the community banks as well as investing within the community.
Great. The third, that private banks are already providing the services that public banks would replicate.
They would, private banks would then have a less risky income stream to count on if they got matching funds from the state of New Mexico, and they wouldn't be so much under the pressure of the big banks. We've all heard about community banks that are folding, and that's not an accident. Some of that has to do with who they're getting their money from.
Well, and I would also say that private banks aren't actually providing the service. Yes. I mean, anybody who's tried to take out a loan knows how incredibly difficult it is.
Or anybody who's tried to renegotiate a foreclosure. Mm-hmm. They're going through 3, 4, 5 reapplications, and the applications are being paid for by the federal government that says you got to sponsor reapplication or modification of your loan. The banks are making money on requiring you to do it again and again and again, so that we have people that are working with We Are People here, our organization, where they have been forced by the big banks. They've never gotten their foreclosure modified. They haven't had their principal amount modified. A public bank could do that. We could say, okay, you're underwater. Let's modify the principal that you owe and keep you in the house, keep you so that the house doesn't fall into ruin, and keep the house from becoming a predator, a target by the big banks that want to say, and they're saying now, buy up all these houses, hold on to them, and we'll take the profits that come from these houses. A public bank can keep you in your house, can negotiate with you just as they did the farmers in North Dakota.
And it's foreclosure. I mean, this is such a big topic. Just a side note here, I am hoping to do a whole show on this next Thursday on foreclosure specifically with some attorneys dealing with people, because the speak of criminality, it's just extraordinary what is happening and how many people are losing their homes here in New Mexico. You all are also giving a talk about that late September, September 24th, correct, about foreclosure specifically?
We're going to have a whole program, Zelly, on September 24th. With people who are in foreclosure and with people who have been finding ways to fight foreclosure in the court, some rather unorthodox ways, but entirely legally based ways to fight foreclosure that have not been on the table, using parts of the Uniform Commercial Code and other ways to approach it that I didn't learn about in law school that are coming up now that are being useful for people in foreclosure. So that September 24th meeting is going to cover ways to fight back, ways the people can get into court to support the individual who feels ashamed and alone. We can do that together, and we can create an organization of people who are in foreclosure. And we're going to start talking about that on the 24th.
Well, and I definitely want to continue the misperceptions, but also there's one talk July 23rd. It's a town hall about public banking. Basically, you two will be discussing this conference that you attended in San Rafael. Mm-hmm. On September 8th, you will be giving a presentation at Journey Santa Fe. So if anybody can't make the 24th or July 23rd, please note all these down, and hopefully it will be on your website as well.
Thank you, Zelly.
Yes, it will.
Yes.
And that website would be?
WeArePeopleHere.org.
Great. Mm-hmm. So one more misconception here, that government being in the banking business is both inefficient and a source for mischief caused by our politicians. Not that our politicians would do any mischief, but this is a...
The one thing that's great about having government be responsible for banking is sunshine laws and the capacity for transparency. And yep, we have mischievous politicians. But they can be caught and brought to justice a lot easier than some of the mischief makers in big banks. That's the main piece about that, I think.
And the inefficiency. I mean, the government shouldn't necessarily be in the banking business.
The government is to represent the people. The government is to represent the people, and it's our commonwealth, it's our common utility.
The history is, in fact, that public banks are much more efficient than the private banks. They don't have to address all their interest returns and their lending returns to shareholders. They can put them into the efficiency of the lending operation itself. So that that statement that public banks are not as effective or efficient is just a throwaway propaganda statement. In fact, public banks, the banking amounts to lending, keeping a good account of it, and not lending bad loans. That can be done by people in government as well as by people who are running Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers.
Absolutely.
And collapsing. So.
And the CEO doesn't make big bucks either. They earn a salary just like any other governmental entity.
Well, this is an important conversation. I hope New Mexico will embrace it. We're speaking with Craig Barnes and Nico Lycan of We Are People Here, July 23rd, September 28th at Journey Santa Fe. You have been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Zelie, sitting in for Mary Charlotte.